Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu. Our guest for this first hour of the show is Tom Keen. He is editor-at-large for Bloomberg News, and he provides economic and investment perspective to all of the Bloomberg formats, print, radio, and TV. He is host of the weekday program Bloomberg on the Economy, that's broadcast on Bloomberg Radio. He writes the Chart of the Day story that's available on the Bloomberg Professional Service. He also presents it on Bloomberg Television. He's been involved in the investment industry for a long time. He worked in the industry for 16 years before going to work at Bloomberg. And he is the editor of a book that's just come out recently, published by Bloomberg, which is titled Flying on One Engine, the Bloomberg Book of Master Market Economists. And the premise here is that they went out and they sought the views of 16 different economists that are employed by major Wall Street firms, firms like Merrill Lynch and Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and Bear Stearns and others, and gave them the opportunity to talk about economic issues that interested them, things like the deficit, like globalization, like the value of the dollar, the challenge posed to the United States by the increasing power of the economies of East Asia, particularly India and China. And you will find all of that in the book. And if you're interested in economic issues, it makes interesting reading. Then we'll talk about some of these things also this morning here with Tom Keen. And questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. We only ask that people try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep moving and get in as many different callers as possible. But, of course, questions and comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number to call. If you were outside of the immediate area here, and if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Keen, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
Great to be with you.
And I hope that I basically, the premise of the book is, as I'd said, you did not assign the topics to the various writers. They wrote on whatever it was they wanted to write about?
Yeah, as editor at large, I get in, David, hundreds and hundreds of reports a day. There's times in the early morning hours between Europe, Asia coming in, there'll be 50 reports in 20 minutes. And so you see what all these people write, and after a time, you get to know what are the issues they have the most passion about. So I went to Robert Hormats, and he's passionate about Asian economics. I said, Bob, can you write me up your vision on Asia? But this was pretty easy because they know that I know what they like. And so we sort of subdivided it out that way. Hmm.
The title of the book comes apparently from a quote from Kenneth Rogoff, who's a professor at Harvard. And
yes,
something that he said, and it, at least, well, it's printed here on the jacket, he said, it's bad enough the global economy has been flying on one engine, but it's going to be a lot worse if it has to land on one wheel.
It was an important quote. Dr. Rogoff was chief economist with the IMF, and he was in Dubai. And he got a bit upset at a press conference and said that to a reporter. And I saw it come into our New York wires off of our Mideast wires. And I said, we've got to write that up. So we wrote it up right away within minutes, and it went out on the Bloomberg. And then the next Friday, The Economist magazine gave it a full page, which was a big deal for them to take that amount of space on the emotion that Rogoff was trying to capture was important. And then a year later, I went to Ken and said, could I use it as my title? And he said not only yes, but he was very generous coming out of the IMF and with all the burdens he has at Harvard to write the introduction for the book. And so I got the best of all worlds with Ken Rogoff there.
Well, that naturally invites the question, what does that mean? And these economists, these professional economists who work for these major Wall Street firms that have contributed to the book, do they think that the world economy is just flying on one engine?
There's a mixture here. I use that as a title to capture the anxieties that are out there in America. As you well know, this economy is booming, but anecdotally, there's a large part of America that doesn't feel that way. And these economists are a mix. There are people here who are optimists, where it comes very easy. There's people here that have some genuine worries about our economic future. Maybe they would call themselves realists. Maybe there's a touch of pessimism here, but it's a mix of views that creates a tension throughout the book. And they're collegial. There's no fist fights or anything like that, academic fist fights, but there are some sharp differences of economic theory, and particularly sharp differences of expectations for the coming years.
Do you think that there are some important ways in which the outlook or the attitude or the way that these economists who work in the private sector approach these questions and the way that academic economists do?
It's an important question, and that's why Ken Rogoff was kind enough to say it's an original book. No one's really sat down with market economists and looked at these kind of questions as we do typically with academic economists. All of these people have first-rate resumes from terrific schools. They all have the proper degrees and such. Many of them worked in academics. Ed McKelvey of Goldman Sachs, who writes the deficit chapter, taught for years at Williams College in Massachusetts, but there is a distinction, and that is time. Academics can sit around and ponder over a summer what becomes the outcome of, say, a five-page paper, a symposium, something like that. These people have to see data at 8:30. They have to digest it for their trading desks by 8:31. They've got to have a six-page note published by 11 a.m. by them and their staffs. And then the key thing is they've got to write a weekly note, which takes 3 to 4 days to construct. And their timeline is much shorter. They were enthusiastic about this project because when they saw the book Flying on One Engine, they said they could take time. Most of it, David, was written on airplane trays. These people travel nonstop, but it gave them a chance to expand from that hurry of market economics, not so much towards academics, but just deeper thinking on the immediate issues that so many people are concerned about.
Yeah. I want to ask you about something that is just now in the news. I'm sure that you will have something to say about it, however, and no doubt these guys, and they are mostly men, would have something to say about it, too.
Let me say something right there.
Yes.
That kills me no end that there aren't more women in this book. Kathleen Stephenson was one of my first phone calls. She's head of global economic research for Credit Suisse. But on my radio program, we try constantly to move forward some of the terrific economists that are out there. And there's more and more women really moving to the forefront. But you're correct to point that out. And it upsets me no end that there's just too many men in this book.
Well, what I want to ask you about was what's happening now in the American auto industry. Apparently, just today, GM has announced major losses, big losses. They already had announced that they would be cutting 30,000 jobs and closing some factories. And then more recently, Ford Motor Company also said, that was just earlier this week, it would cut 30,000 jobs. It would close 14 plants over the next 6 years. Does what's happening with the auto industry, does that simply tell you something about the auto industry, or does it say something to you about the American economy as a whole?
It says to me personally that it is a mix of issues. When I went to find a chief executive officer to say something about the book, I was thrilled that Rick Wagoner, the head of GM, was kind enough to mention it. And I was pleased with that because Rick Wagoner has an economics degree from Duke University. Rick Wagoner has his hands full. It is one part product, having the right cars. Chrysler's doing relatively better because they've got the right cars now. It is one part old auto versus new auto. That's a big, big issue in terms of the costs. But it is part economics. It is part of structural industry and in our structural economic nation. And it is about something bigger than the auto industry. And it really comes down to this idea of how are we managing technology. Robert Solow wrote an important paper in 1957 a long time ago. I think that's 49 years ago, if I do the math quickly. And in that, he talked about this strange thing of technology and what it does to growth and where we get growth from. And the auto industry is dealing with that as a high-skilled, high-expense, high-labor-cost industry with that. So it's a mixture of challenges that they face, and as you're well aware, that's accelerated in the recent months and years, in the recent quarters, till we get up to these big announcements, which many experts we speak to at Bloomberg say should have happened 2 years ago, 5 years ago, even 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that some people really want to say that it's some sort of an object lesson that unless you are flexible, unless you can't be successful in business if you're saying to your customers, here's the product, take it or leave it. What you've really got to do is get some sort of idea about what it is they want. Mm-hmm. And you've got to be willing to be able to, if you know, ideally, to turn on a dime if customers change their minds about what they want. And I think people would say both those things make both those criticisms of the American auto industry. That is, it's not flexible. It doesn't turn on a dime. It doesn't even turn on a dollar. And that for too long, what the industry did was it said to consumers, here's the product, take it or leave it.
And particularly the industry out of Detroit, I think there could be some criticisms justified there. I interviewed David Cole of the Center for Automotive Research. I believe it was the day after the Ford announcements. Can't quite remember, but a few days ago. And he makes very clear it is the lessons learned within a competitive landscape. And clearly, every study we've seen at Bloomberg shows that an entrenched industry took a long, long time to learn lessons from competitors that were very visible. I met with the head of Chrysler North America recently, Tom Lasorda, and it was an on-the-record interview, and he made very clear to me the distinctive manufacturing feature is laser robot methods. Now, that's not economics. That's technology. But that's why some of the cars not produced traditionally in America have better tolerances and the doors close better. That's simple. So it's this issue of learning economic lessons and business lessons, and not only learning them, but the time function as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that for some time now, people have been saying that sooner or later, GM is going to lose its status as the biggest automaker in the world. And I think the expectation is that that it will be Toyota, and it may indeed happen sometime this year. It'll be sooner rather than later, and it makes you wonder exactly what the future of these companies are and whether they will ever be what they once were.
I think that's the will they ever be what they were is very clearly answered by the people we speak to, and the answer is it's over. Mm-hmm. The past is just simply not going to be replicated. I will say this, and I think this permeates the book as well. There has to be an inherent optimism about the American economic flexibility, our malleability. One of my great heroes is James McGregor Burns, the Williams College historian, and that's the heart of his historical theory is there's something different here. There's an ability here, looking at Schumpeterian creative destruction, there's an ability here to get problem solved, clear the market out, and move on. And just when you think something's at its worst, America has a resiliency here. Throughout the book, you sense that. The gloomiest chapter in my book is Thomas Mayer's book on Europe. He's a chief European economist for Deutsche Bank and one of the giants of synthesizing European history and thought. And that is in stark difference from the other 15 chapters, which have that underlying optimism that, as you said, flexibility, we can get things solved.
Yeah. Our guest, Thomas Keene, he's editor-at-large for Bloomberg News and does work in all of their various formats, print, radio, and television. He is the host of the weekday program Bloomberg on the Economy on Bloomberg Radio, and he is the editor of a new collection of essays contributed by economists who work at major Wall Street firms. The title of the book is Flying on One Engine. It's published by Bloomberg, so you can seek it out in the bookstore. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk about what it is that these people that you talk to, how it is they reflect on what's been happening here in the economy, say, over the last couple of decades, looking back to that time when things certainly were booming. Some people would say that there was unnatural exuberance and that it couldn't last, and eventually we hit the wall, that things were made worse by 9/11. There has been some recovery, but I think that people, I don't know if it's just that they think that things should be better, or they look back to the true boom time of the late 90s, and that's their benchmark. Yeah. But I think that, and while I think people would say that, as I said, people would say, yes, things are better, that they're not maybe as good as they could be, should be, or we would like them to be. What do these guys that you talk to that write for this book have to say about what's happened here now, roughly speaking, over about the last, 10 years?
They have widely different opinions, is the answer. This is a place where if you got all these guys in a room with a cocktail in their hand, you'd have a very interesting cocktail party. David Malpass at Bear Stearns makes real clear that the employment boom that we saw in the late 90s was simply a sharp movement above trend, and all we're really doing is coming back to a more normative labor economy. Where there's others in the book, I think of Stephen Roach at Morgan Stanley, their chief economist, and David Rosenberg at Merrill Lynch, their chief North American economist, who are very, very concerned about the kind of jobs we're getting in this strange, strange economy in the last 5 years. That's a pretty darn good economy, David. It's not bad. It is above trend. The president can get up on a podium and say, we have a strong economy. He's right. Why do so many Americans not enjoy it and look back into, say, 1997, 1998, is a time when things were good? And one part of it is it was truly a booming equity markets, and that in this economy, if you own a house, maybe you feel pretty good. If you don't, yeah, don't feel good. But so much of this is this idea of productivity that permeates every chapter of the book. Productivity is something we spent a lot of time on my radio program on. It's the efficiency of the economy. And I think of Dale Jorgensen at Harvard, who some would say owns the franchise on productivity economics. It's been above trend. It's simply been surprisingly high productivity going back to the middle 1990s. And if you have high productivity, you're getting more out of labor, which means fewer people are employed on a relative basis, which means you don't have to raise wages. So those are the tensions that you end up cycling through over 10 years. And there's a heated debate over where productivity is going to go now. One school says productivity is going to remain elevated, and we're not going to see the wage gains we typically see this far into a recovery. So that angst that we feel now versus the good times we felt in 97 may not go away.
Hmm. Well, I suppose there are also some people who would make this argument that wages, really, truly, wages haven't grown since the 1970s. They have been stagnant since, and it's certainly the cost of living has not been stagnant. We see what happens with real estate values, for example. We also know that Americans are very heavily leveraged. There's a lot of debt out there. We're not very good savers, maybe never have been, but particularly aren't now. And that's just a kind of, all of that is just not sustainable. We can't keep going like that.
There's again, in all of those issues you just mentioned, debate. On savings alone, you can literally go chapter, and the economists have different views on, do we have low savings? Is there a savings concern? Some are grievously concerned. Stephen Roach is essentially beside himself over this lack of savings in America. David Malpass at Bear Stearns says the savings is in investments and in the capital gains kind of items that aren't measured within the data. He is less concerned. But within all of this sweep of issues, you're going to get nuance and debate, and that's what we try to do in the book: is elicit the debate, generate the debate, if you will, so that the reader can learn more about the debate, not only about the issues, and not so much choose right or wrong or which side of the fence you're on, but begin to see the nuances within the debate. Mm-hmm. And what I would come back to, and I've said this in many different interviews, is this idea of two Americas that John Edwards came up with in the campaign. That's the real distinction here, is the polarization of the economic landscape within America and its link to politics.
Let's talk with a couple of callers here. We'll start out with someone in Charleston on our line number 4, toll-free line right here. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I had two issues I'd like you to address, and I'll hang up afterwards. And the first was, I just heard the president saying he thinks tax cuts are a good thing for the economy, and he's looking forward to a debate with Congress coming into this. And you mentioned one of your contributors is just passionate about the deficit. So I'd like you to address that issue. And second of all, something you just touched on, the two Americas, what was the general feeling of your contributors regarding the widening income gap and the danger that poses?
These are important questions. First, on the tax cuts. Most economists, for example, on free trade, there isn't an economist who's against free trade. Theoretically, they all agree with it, even the most liberal economists concerned about economics. Tax cuts are the same way. There's never been a tax cut an economist didn't like. If you go through the microeconomics of taxes, tax cuts are a good thing. But within that, you have to have a balanced budget or something approximating it. And there's deep, deep division. That is linked to the deficit debate. The chapter that focuses most on the deficit is Bill Dudley and Ed McKelvey at Goldman Sachs, who I think it's safe to say own the deficit economics franchise. Their work is considered authoritative. They have been surprised by tax receipts. The deficit is better now. It's improved. There is great concern if you go out anywhere from 3 years to 5 years, and certainly out 8 and 10 years on the spending side. I interviewed Josh Bolton of the Office of Management and Budget, the president's budget advisor, last Friday. He shares that same concern out 10 years. And that's, again, linked to this tax cut debate. And there you get into the idea of flows, and there's issues on how we solve this, how we go about it. But the short answer is there's one school that thinks we're going to grow our way into higher tax revenues, and there's one school that doubts that. And that's the cusp of the debate. And throughout the book, in each chapter, they discuss, these economists discuss the likelihood, can we grow economic growth and boost up taxes with that, or do we need to actually raise taxes or remove the tax cuts to bring back some sort of budget responsibility? On the two Americas, I think there's a clear idea that there's been a polarization over the last 20 years or so. There's gradations, David, and the caller. There's a gradation about is the polarity advancing? Is it shrinking? And is the issue to keep, not to diminish the successful part of that polarity and pull up those that are challenged, or should we singularly focus on what to do with those that are falling behind economically?
All right. Well, I hope that gets at the points of the caller. And I think that this does indeed touch on one of the criticisms that has been made of the Bush administration, having to do with its proposals to try to stimulate the economy and to encourage job growth and so forth. And the critics say that the administration's only got one tool in its kit, tax cuts. And that so it sounds as if among these people that you talk to, and generally the kind of people you talk to, that there's not really a consensus about, or is there some sort of disappointment? Would they like to hear something more? I mean, they may think that tax cuts are fine, but they might say, look, let's have something else. Let's just not have that.
This is a really important question, David, and it's an immediate question with the President's State of the Union on Tuesday. This is an administration where we can say there's been a few legislative events. Many people within Flying on One Engine will say the tax reductions was a big event and advanced forward this economy, whether there was wage growth or not. But certainly, if you look at the three-part economic items of Social Security reform, tax reform, and health care reform, there's been, for the most part, a silence. I don't think we have to diverge off into the Medicare subscription bill, prescription bill, mm-hmm. but certainly Social Security reform had, to be kind, challenges last year. I read today the tax reform really won't be pushed forward in 2006, and there's just the beginning of a percolation of discussion of health care reform. I was with Karl Rove last week, and even he was talking up this idea of health care reform. So the answer is there hasn't been much action, and these economists are aware of that. And yes, they're frustrated by it. But right now, there's a real question of what's next. And I guess it all comes back to politics. Tom Gallagher of ISI, Institute for Strategic Economics, for ISI in Washington, writes my chapter on the political economics of Washington, and he constantly goes back to that polarity, that stratification that's out there.
Hmm. Well, maybe one, two other callers here. I promise I'll get right to them. But just to raise one more point that comes off of what you were just talking about, I think that there are some people that are, a lot of people that are worried, increasingly worried about the rising social costs that government in the future is going to have to meet, particularly costs connected with the fact that the percentage of the population that's in the older age ranges is growing and will continue to grow.
Yes.
And when we look at things like Social Security and Medicare, and if you toss in something like the fact that maybe in the future the government might have to pick up the tab for pensions for workers whose companies say they can't meet the bill anymore, we start to pile up some significant numbers, and I think there are some people who are justifiably concerned that over the next 10, 15, 20 years, that's going to be, add all that up, it's going to be just staggering. Is that something that people like the people you've talked to worry about?
Yes, and that's the frustrating point. You wonder, why isn't anything getting done, when if I line up 15 big shots in economics, I guarantee you 15 of them are exactly as concerned as you put it so nicely. What's interesting is Josh Bolton of the Bush administration shares the same exact concern of, say, Peter Orszag of the Brookings Institution, who is considered an economic advisor traditionally to Democratic office holders. So there is a unified concern about future obligations. And then the debate stops. And that's the great frustration now, is these kind of tough decisions really aren't moving forward. In one of my introductions to the chapter in the book, I talk about taking future problems and leaving them for our grandchildren. That appears to be what's happening, and I would suggest it will be part of the presidential debate in 2008.
Yeah. Well, I just find myself wondering, again, because for the kind of people that you talk to, whether they feel, as it seems the administration seems to feel, is that ultimately they're turning around and they're taking these costs and they're passing them back to individuals, and they're basically saying, look, this is something that you're going to have to deal with. Maybe we can help a little bit, but this is your problem. And then on the other hand, there are people who say, no, that there is some sort of a larger global responsibility that government has, acknowledging the fact that that government has to try to provide for people's welfare.
And philosophically, this goes to the heart of the matter, and you'll hear the administration and their supporters speak of this all the time, this idea of individualism. We certainly saw it within the Social Security debate. I think of Senator Sarbanes of Maryland, who is known for Sarbanes-Oxley and corporate reform. The thing that really gets him going is the actuarial realities of defined contribution or 401k programs. Are they properly funded? And as you say, we're moving from this idea of a corporation funding a retirement, a defined benefit plan, and we're shifting over to the individual responsible for those decisions and those future obligations. And within all the work we do at Bloomberg News out of our Washington office and really around the world, this debate of a public good or a corporate good versus an individual good is really at the heart of the matter of the past 10 years and even 20 years and certainly going out 50 years. I mentioned Peter Orszag. He is adamant that the shortest quick solution is when you sign up for a job, you have an automatic 401k deduction. Just start your job day one with some kind of 401k deduction to boost up 401k contributions, because it's not happening.
Yeah. Our guest, let me introduce, and I'll get right to the callers. They've been very patient. Our guest is Tom Keene. He is editor-at-large for Bloomberg News and works in all of their various formats in print, in radio, and TV. He writes the Chart of the Day story that's available on the Bloomberg Professional Service. He also presents it on Bloomberg Television. He is host of the weekday program Bloomberg on the Economy, which is on Bloomberg Radio, and he worked for the investment industry for 16 years before joining Bloomberg. He is the editor of a book that brings together the views of 16 different economists that work for major Wall Street firms on some of the issues here that we have talked about. The title of the book is Flying on One Engine, and it's published by Bloomberg. No surprise. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and we have a number of them, and we'll start in with line one in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Inge started out with noting that there aren't any women in your list, and I was thinking I'm quite sure there probably aren't any populists in your group either. That is, people who hold that the common person's interests are being hindered or oppressed by an elite in a society. Economists are kind of the PR hacks for the wealthy.
Let me address
that. To give you an idea where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I understand exactly. And we had Jeff Soh of the Economic Policy Institute on my radio program the other day, who's one of the great, great populists of all time. So, you know, we try to do that. And I'm going to keep my answer short because I know there's a lot of callers.
Well, I have a question beyond this statement.
Oh, I thought that was your question.
No. My question is, I just wanted to give you an idea where I'm coming from.
I'll try to keep it short just because we've got a lot of callers.
Yeah. I put current account deficit in my web search engine, and I came up with an article by John Barry back in June of 2004.
Yep.
And he said the deficit is more than 5% of gross domestic product, double or more the level economists say could be maintained indefinitely. And then further on, he says, if nothing happens in the next 2 or 3 years to reduce the current account deficit, and the chances of a financial disruption
rise
in an alarming way. Recently, projections have shown that the U.S. current account
deficit, we got a lot of calls. What's the question, please?
8% of U.S. GDP by 2008, and that the U.S. dollar might have to depreciate by as much as 30%. In order to trim the current account deficit. So tell me, what does your group of economists have to say about that whole issue?
The current account deficit is a major issue. It is topic one abroad. It is topic one at Davos. I just got back from Shanghai. It's topic one in China. Catherine Mann is very good on this. She's not in the book, but she's cited in the book. She's at the Institute for International Economics. And the answer is, it exists. It's tangible. It's been there a long time. Everybody's paying attention to it. Some economists feel it's in control and will be solved through growth of other nations. This is something you'll hear Secretary Snow talk about a lot, that the real solution is economic growth in Europe, economic growth in Japan. Other people are far more concerned and feel that the solution will be a weaker dollar, which is one way to solve it, not always productive. But another way to solve it is for a greater trade, better exports by us. It's safe to say the only reason it's leveled out recently is a terrific sales of the Boeing airplane company. Boeing has made a demonstrable difference in our export growth. But the real distinction in the math, which is covered in the book by Tim O'Neill of Bank of Montreal, Kathleen Stephenson of Credit Suisse and others, is our insatiable demand for imports, and that, with the latest data, appears to be continuing.
All right, let's go on to another caller, and I think the next person in line would be in her Banna line number two.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Yes.
When you were talking about disparity, about 10 years ago, about 1991 or two, a guy wrote, an economist wrote a paper, and the gist of it was, he called it Islands of Prosperity, where you'd have these highly educated, you know, desirable class of people who would sort of float within this economy, everybody, the middle class sort of disappearing, and I think that's sort of coming to fruition now. But if we were talking about deficits and stuff, and you were talking about government spending, isn't it true that the all this mess in Iraq and all this other stuff, like, is off budget? When is this included in the deficit?
Yeah.
The $300 billion they've blown in Iraq. I mean, when are these bills due? Go ahead.
That's a good, important question, and I think it will be a big part of the political campaigns of this November in 2008. In short, the only off-budget item right now where I'm hearing economists say clearly that that you can take it off budget would be Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah,
that's looked at as a one-off budget. The latest number Josh Bolton told me was 80-some billion. Clearly, it's going to be a bigger number, but I don't hear much angst by economists, including those in Flying on One Engine, about Katrina. The war is different. There's a number of ways of budgeting and measuring the cost of the war. The answer is, economists are just as concerned about the time function, the length of time, as they are about the annual cost.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, it's off budget, and there is a heated debate, not so much about morally, should it be on budget, should it be off budget? The debate is what portion of those military efforts should migrate to what part of the budget or off budget. And I would predict in the coming weeks and months, this is going to be a growing growing part of the debate. Dudley and McKelvey, who again write from Goldman Sachs, who write the chapter on the deficit, which I might point out is the most readable chapter in the book, they make clear they would put much of it on budget, or at least pretend it's on budget in terms of concerns for the future.
Well, yeah, I just want to make one more comment. It seems to me like, you know, everybody's got a schema, you know, or a scheme to do something. Like you said, they pretend it's on budget. I mean, in reality, all of us have to pay our bills unless we die, fortunately, and leave everybody with all of our debts. But I just don't understand. I mean, I've followed economics for years, and I read economists. I read, the Economist magazine. I read all these kind of journals and the Wall Street Journal. And I'm kind of looking at these people and thinking, it sounds to me like a shell game. You know, well, we can do this, we can do that. I mean, you have Bush. I want to make another point. I think about a week ago, I read the U.S. Treasury had receipts 8% lower than the quarter, you know, the equal quarter before the year before. So you know anything about that? I mean, is the Treasury actually taking in less money because of these tax cuts, to use that? Because I think they're euphemisms, because they're basically given to very wealthy. I didn't get a major tax cut.
The way that we measure tax receipts is as a percent of the overall economy. It has improved recently to help your listeners, David. In the Clinton years, when we had this boom economy, for whatever reason, tax receipts as a percent of GDP were, call it, 21%. And then they plunged with the tax cuts, and off the top of my head, I'm going to say they plunged to 16%. So the line went from 20 down to 16. 18 or 19 is normative. So it's come up a little bit recently, but it's still, tax receipts as a percent of the economy are still under the long-term average. Now, when you filter that into your other concerns about accounting, I would say there are numerous bodies, both Republican, Democrat, those that are supposedly unaligned, who keep track of all this within the debate. And within the swirl of budget economics that we look at Bloomberg News, it's part of that debate. And people know this group says this angle, this group says that angle. The issue is when it filters through the political process, what portions of that get through the debate? And I'll tell you, it mostly comes down to just hard politics. The economic debate of about all the budget items on, off the balance sheet is tangible and real. It's when it shifts to the politics that the debate changes.
All right, let's talk with Champaign County next, line three. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, indicators are flying around in circles. There's one that I don't think gets enough comment on. We hear a lot about productivity gains, et cetera. But out of the last 10 months, I believe it's only two of the last 10 months have hourly wages gone up. And it just strikes me that people are like quizzical, like, why isn't everybody appreciating what a nice economy we have? All the indicators that I look at are nice, but people who look at their
paychecks,
I mean, it isn't there. So why should, it's like people are being sold this, like the economy's good. And
it's the number one question I ask people on my radio program. You're dead on. There are three ways that economists measure wages or paychecks or compensation. One is off the GDP data, and those numbers look great. The other one on the other side is just what you said, average hourly earnings, which is a more blue-collar, more working man statistic. It doesn't look great. Real wages are lousy when you measure them within the unemployment surveys. In the middle is something called ECI, or the Employment Cost Index, which is a measurement of wages and benefits. All the economists disagree on which is most important. The people concerned, as you are, look at average hourly wages. The optimists look at the GDP numbers, which are remarkably strong. Let's focus on the middle. One of the interesting things in the middle is there's been a tangible shift from wage growth to benefit growth.
Well, that's because our insurance costs are going up and medical costs are going up.
Yes.
Exactly that. I have one other comment, and that's about retirement. The substance of the Vanguard case that Alito recused himself from eventually was solved the same way eventually. But why I understand that, and I have been searching the web, there's not much comment on it, was that a person whose husband died, she was suing because Vanguard liquidated her IRAs, I gather, to make up for arrears that he left owing. And it seems to me that, the IRAs are supposed to be inviolate. They're supposed to be a retirement fund. And if they start chipping it away at the solidity of IRAs, mm-hmm. I mean, you can, okay, your 401k is fine, and you think you've got something. But in this case, it went away for her.
Right. I'm not up to speed on that debate, and certainly not up to speed on what occurred with the judge's testimony at Congress. So I'm not going to comment specifically on that matter. I will say from my days in the investment business that one of the great pieces of legislation in the history of this nation is the Employment Retirement Income Security Act of 1974 that President Carter signed after initiation that went all the way back to Eisenhower. It's a terrific body of law and improved the welfare of all sorts of people to protect those kind of assets you're talking about. The IRA on the back end has some very, very interesting features, particularly if there's a lot of money in the account. And there has not been, you are right, there has not been enough awareness of some of the ramifications. If you have large value IRAs on the death of the holder, and particularly on the death of their spouse. I've heard about this before, and I think, frankly, it's all public service you brought it up. It's something anybody that has a lot of money in IRA should certainly be aware of, but I'm not going to comment specifically on the judge's testimony.
All right. Well, I thank the caller. Let's go on to Belgium. This is a community nearby on our line number four. Hello.
Good morning, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I have something I don't understand here, sir. You say the productivity in the United States is going up and up. Obviously, your last caller just mentioned that wages are not going up and up.
Right.
If you walk into Walmart or any place like that, you're hard-pressed to find something that's made in the United States.
Yep.
Textiles are gone. Chair manufacturing, forget it. It's all someplace else. Furniture manufacturing is from elsewhere. Cars, Most of it is from someplace else, though we may put them together here.
Yep.
All the parts come from someplace else. Sir, we cannot build a country that does not produce durable goods.
Let me comment on that, and this is one of the great, great issues that I covered in the campaign. The manufacturing sector of this nation has been on a relentless, steady decline going back to about 1950, 1955. If you plot it what's called logarithmically, which is some fancy math on the chart, it's literally a straight line down. It got worse 5 years ago. There's clearly been a change in the long-term structural decline of manufacturing. Many economists, including Tim O'Neill, who's in Flying on One Engine, will go back to one phrase, transportation, transportation, transportation. And it's something that cannot be ignored. We've been able to transfer, or as John Lipsky and Jim Glassman say in one of their books and one of the chapters, transform how we do business. And you're correct to observe that a larger and larger part of our manufacturing base has been transformed abroad. Economists, for the most part, are adamant. They're absolutely adamant that you can replace manufacturing jobs with so-called service sector jobs. Almost to a person, you'll hear this. Americans don't agree. There's no question when you talk to Americans, they will say that's not true. And the distinction is perhaps that the kind of jobs you and I remember, and I grew up in Rochester, New York, with a big manufacturing company, Eastman Kodak, which has been put out of obsolescence by digital cameras, essentially. But the issue here is less manufacturing versus service sector, in that those jobs were high paying. And so it has to do with wages. It has to do with labor economics and labor rate. And as Stephen Roach says in his chapter in my book, the labor arbitrage is extraordinary. The wage differentials of those industries you're talking about, it's not a question of nuance. There is a titanic width, a Grand Canyon width, if you will, a Pacific Ocean width between wage rates in Illinois, wage rates as I stand here looking out over Boston, and the wage rates going down the food chain of Mexico, Brazil, and you can pick the country in Asia that you'd like. So that's what we have to struggle with going forward, is these wage differentials, which are so, so titanic.
Well, sir, even with the wage difference, we as a people have to realize that we cannot chase the lowest price, because we do it at the detriment of our own jobs and our own country, because pay ourselves.
I hear this constantly, and it is part of the debate. Barry Eichengreen of University of California, Berkeley, who's one of the smartest people I know on this, is adamant. He's absolutely forceful in his speeches that we will confront this politically as we move out of 2007 into 2008. When I was interviewing him in 2003, he was saying it's not the 2004 election where this will come up finally for national debate. It will be much more the next presidential election. And it's not that I agree with him. I usually don't give my opinion. But I will say there's many economists greatly concerned about all of those flows and those equations, if you will, that they finally come to the focal point that I hear in your frustration. It's not here yet. Maybe it will be here in 2 years, where the nation will finally engage the debate you're talking about.
I want to thank the caller, and we're very short on time. Maybe I can get at least one more. Just, though, a quick follow-up. The change that we have talked about, this change in the economy and the change in wages that attach, does anybody think that there's any going back, or would most people say this is a permanent change?
I'll give a short answer because I don't know where we are on the clock, David. The very, very simple answer is economists across all political perspectives believe in free trade. The issue is making the distinction is making it equal nation to nation is a center point. They are critically concerned that WTO and negotiations like that that are bilateral and multilateral move forward. What we don't hear about is going back to the regional bloc challenges of, say, the 1930s that led to so much difficulty in the late 1930s and into the 1940s.
All right, well, quickly, we'll see if we can talk with someone here in Chicago. Line two. Hello.
We certainly don't need any more natural disasters or wars to destabilize the economy. Yet there are areas of investments such as hedge funds and derivatives that are in the trillions that, if they're not on more solid footing, could certainly contribute to destabilization or thwarting of the economy. Do you have any comment on that?
Yes, I do. I'm glad you brought that up. David Goldman will be on my show out of New York this afternoon in an hour or so. He wrote my chapter exactly on what you're talking about. Off the record, every single government official I talk to is concerned about this. Timothy Geithner, the president of the New York Fed, is leading the charge on this. He gave a speech on his way to Davos about it. There is significant concerns about the derivatives, their notional value, which is in the trillions, and what would occur if we had a series, or one big shock. This is front and center on the minds of people. Chairman Greenspan was speaking about this long before others. It is truly a concern on and off the record as I talk to people about it, and they're studying it. They're trying to figure out what would happen and also how to monitor it into any kind of shock. Remember, there's a great complacency out there in economics and in investment right now. It's been very, very quiet now for a couple years in terms of shocks.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. Our guest is Thomas Kean. He's editor-at-large for Bloomberg News. He is also the editor of this book, Flying on One Engine, that presents the views of 16 different economists who work for major Wall Street firms on the issues here we've been discussing. It's published by Bloomberg Press. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore if you want to take a look at it. And Mr. Kean, thank you very much.
My great pleasure.